saw that beneath the gaudy summertime trappings, Falmouth boasted some grand old 19th-century buildings, one of which housed the Palacio Lounge Café and restaurant. The high ceilings and classical proportions of what looked like an old courthouse had been decorated in a self-consciously whimsical style, which included garish orange floral wallpaper, hundreds of kitschy paintings in pastel frames, and a stuffed fox dressed as a magistrate. The clientele, which was dominated by students and families, sat on mismatched wooden chairs, their chatter echoing through the cavernous space. After a few seconds, Robin spotted Strike, large and surly-looking at the back of the room, seeming far from happy beside a pair of families whose many young children, most of whom were wearing tie-dyed clothing, were racing around between tables. Robin thought she saw the idea of standing to greet her cross Strike's mind as she wound her way through the tables towards him. But if she was right, he decided against. She knew how he looked when his leg was hurting him, the lines around his mouth deeper than usual, as though he had been clenching his jaw. If Robin had looked tired in a dusty bed and breakfast mirror 3 hours previously, Strike looked utterly drained, his unshaven jaw appearing dirty, the shadows under his eyes dark blue.
"Morning," he said,
struggling to make himself heard over the merry shrieking of the hippie children.
"Get parked okay?"
"Just round the corner," she said, sitting down.
"I chose this place because I thought it would be easy to find," he said.
A small boy knocked into their table, causing Strike's coffee to slop over onto his plate, which was littered with croissant flakes, and ran off again.
"What do you want?"
"Coffee would be great,"
said Robin loudly, over the cries of the children beside them.
"How are things in St. Maur's?"
"Same,"
said Strike.
"I'm sorry,"
said Robin.
"Why, it's not your fault,"
grunted Strike. This was hardly the greeting Robin had expected after a 2.5-hour drive to pick him up. Possibly her annoyance showed, because Strike added,
"Thanks for doing this. Appreciate it."
"Oh, don't pretend you can't see me, dipshit," he added crossly, as a young waiter walked away without spotting his raised hand.
"I'll go to the counter," said Robin. "I need the loo anyway."
By the time she'd peed and managed to order a coffee from a harassed waiter, a tension headache had begun to pound on the left-hand side of her head. On her return to the table, she found Strike looking like thunder, because the children at the next tables were now shrieking louder than ever as they raced around their oblivious parents, who simply shouted over the din. The idea of giving Strike Charlotte's telephone message right now passed through Robin's mind, only to be dismissed. In fact, the main reason for Strike's foul mood was that the end of his amputated leg was agony. He'd fallen, like a total tit, as he told himself, while getting onto the Falmouth ferry. This feat required a precarious descent down worn stone steps without a handhold, then a step down into the boat with only the boatman's hand for assistance. At 16 stone, Strike was hard to stabilize when he slipped, and slip he had, with the result that he was now in a lot of pain. Robin took paracetamol out of her bag.
"Headache," she said, catching Strike's eye.
"I'm not bloody surprised," he said loudly,
looking at the parents shouting at each other over the raucous yells of their offspring, but they didn't hear him. The idea of asking Robin for painkillers crossed Strike's mind, but this might engender inquiries and fussing, and he'd had quite enough of those in the past week, so he continued to suffer in silence.
"Where's the client?"
she asked, after downing her pills with coffee.
"About 5 minutes' drive away. Place called Woodhouse Terrace."
At this point, the smallest of the children racing around nearby tripped and smacked her face on the wooden floor. The child's shrieks and wails of pain pounded against Robin's eardrums.
"Oh, Daffy," said one of the tie-dyed mothers shrilly, "what have you done?"
The child's mouth was bloody. Her mother crouched beside their table, loudly castigating and soothing, while the girl's siblings and friends watched avidly. The ferrygoers this morning had worn similar expressions when Strike had hit the deck.
"He's got a false leg,"
the ferryman had shouted, partly, Strike suspected, in case anyone thought the fall was due to his negligence. The announcement had in no way lessened Strike's mortification or the interest of his fellow travellers.
"Shall we get going?" Robin asked, already on her feet.
"Definitely," said Strike, wincing as he stood and picked up his hold-all. "Bloody kids," he muttered, limping after Robin towards the sunlight.
Chapter 6 Fair lady, heart of flint would rue the undeserved woes and sorrows which ye shew. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. Woodhouse Terrace lay on a hill with a wide view of the bay below. Many of the houses had had loft conversions, but Anna and Kim's, as they saw from the street, had been more extensively modified than any other, with what looked like a square glass box where once there had been roof.
"What does Anna do?" asked Robin, as they climbed the steps towards the deep blue front door.
"No idea," said Strike, "but her wife's a psychologist. I got the impression she isn't keen on the idea of an investigation."
He pressed the doorbell. They heard footsteps on what sounded like bare wood, and the door was opened by Dr. Sullivan, tall, blonde, and barefoot in jeans and a shirt, the sun glinting off her spectacles. She looked from Strike to Robin, apparently surprised.
"My partner, Robin Ellicott," Strike explained.
"Oh," said Kim, looking displeased. "You do realize this is only supposed to be an exploratory meeting."
"Robin happened to be just up the coast on another case, so..."
"I'm more than happy to wait in the car," said Robin politely, "if Anna would rather speak to Cormoran alone." "Well, we'll see how Anna feels."
Standing back to admit them, Kim added, "Straight upstairs, in the sitting room." The house had clearly been remodeled throughout, and to a high standard. Everywhere was bleached wood and glass. The bedroom, as Robin saw through an open door, had been relocated to the ground floor, along with what looked like a study. Upstairs, in the glass box they'd seen from the street, was an open-plan area combining kitchen, dining and sitting room, with a dazzling view of the sea. Anna was standing beside a gleaming expensive coffee machine, wearing a baggy blue cotton jumpsuit and white canvas shoes, which to Robin looked stylish, and to Strike, frumpy. Her hair was tied back, revealing the delicacy of her bone structure.
"Oh, hello," she said, starting at the sight of them. "I didn't hear the door over the coffee machine."
"Annie," said Kim, following Strike and Robin into the room, "this is Robin Ellicott, Cameron's partner. She's happy to go if you'd rather just talk to—"
"Cormoran," Anna corrected Kim.
"Do people get that wrong a lot?" she asked Strike.
"More often than not," he said, but with a smile. "But it's a bloody stupid name."
Anna laughed. "I don't mind you staying," she told Robin, advancing and offering a handshake. "I think I read about you too," she added, and Robin pretended that she didn't notice Anna glancing down at the long scar on her forearm.
"Please sit down," said Kim, gesturing Strike and Robin to an inbuilt seating area around a low perspex table.
"Coffee?" suggested Anna, and both of them accepted. A ragdoll cat came prowling into the room, stepping delicately through the puddles of sunlight on the floor, its clear blue eyes like Joan's across the bay. After subjecting both Strike and Robin to dispassionate scrutiny, it leapt lightly onto the sofa and into Strike's lap.
"Ironically," said Kim, as she carried a tray laden with cups and biscuits to the table, "Cagney absolutely loves men."
Strike and Robin laughed politely. Anna brought over the coffee pot, and the two women sat down side by side, facing Strike and Robin, their faces in the full glare of the sun, until Anna reached for a remote control, which automatically lowered cream-coloured sunblinds.
"Wonderful place," said Robin, looking around.
"Thanks," said Kim.
"Her work," she said, patting Anna's knee. "She's an architect."
Anna cleared her throat.
"I want to apologize," she said,
looking steadily at Strike with her unusual silver-gray eyes,
for the way I behaved last night. I'd had a few glasses of wine. You probably thought I was a crank.
If I'd thought that, said Strike, stroking the loudly purring cat, I wouldn't be here.
But mentioning the medium probably gave you entirely the wrong... Because, believe me, Kim's already told me what a fool I was to go and see her. I don't think you're a fool, Annie, Kim said quietly. I think you're vulnerable. There's a difference.
May I ask what the medium said? Asked Strike.
Does it matter? Asked Kim, looking at Strike with what Robin thought was mistrust.
Not in an investigative sense, said Strike, but as he, she, is the reason Anna approached me.
It was a woman, said Anna, and she didn't really tell me anything useful.
Not that I...
With a nervous laugh, she shook her head and started again. I know it was a stupid thing to do. I've been through a difficult time recently. I left my firm and I'm about to turn 40 and... Well, Kim was away on a course and I... Well, I suppose I wanted... She waved her hands dismissively, took a deep breath and said, She's quite an ordinary-looking woman who lives in Chiswick. Her house was full of angels made of pottery and glass. I mean, and there was a big one painted on velvet over the fireplace. Kim, Anna pressed on, and Robin glanced at the psychologist, whose expression was impassive. Kim thinks she, the medium, knew who my mother was, that she googled me before I arrived. I'd given her my real name. When I got there, I simply said that my mother died a long time ago. Although, of course, said Anna, with another nervous wave of her thin hands, there's no proof that my mother's dead. That's half the... But anyway, I told the medium she died and that nobody had ever been clear with me about how it happened. So the woman went into a... Well, I suppose you'd call it a trance, Anna said, looking embarrassed. And she told me that people thought they were protecting me for my own good, but that it was time I knew the truth and that I would soon have a leading that would take me to it. And she said, Your mother's very proud of you, and she's always watching over you, and things like that. I suppose they're boilerplate. And then, at the end, she lies in a holy place.
Lies in a holy place, repeated Strike.
Yes. I suppose she thought that would be comforting. But I'm not a churchgoer. The sanctity or otherwise of my mother's final resting place, if she's buried, I mean, it's hardly my primary concern.
Do you mind if I take notes? Strike asked.
He pulled out a notebook and pen, which Cagney the cat appeared to think were for her personal amusement. She attempted to bat the pen around as Strike wrote the date. Come here, you silly animal, said Kim, getting up to lift the cat clear and put her back on the warm wooden floor.
To begin at the beginning, said Strike, you must have been very young when your mother went missing.
Just over a year old, said Anna, so I can't remember her at all. There were no photographs of her in the house while I was growing up. I didn't know what had happened for a long time. Of course, there was no internet back then. Anyway, my mother kept her own surname after marriage. I grew up as Anna Phipps, which is my father's name. If anybody had said Margot Bamborough to me before I was 11, I wouldn't have known she had any connection to me. I thought Cynthia was my mum. She was my childminder when I was little, she explained. She's a third cousin of my father's and quite a bit younger than him, but she's a Phipps too, so I assumed we were a standard nuclear family. I mean, why wouldn't I? I do remember once I'd started school questioning why I was calling Sin, Sin, instead of Mum. But then Dad and Sin decided to get married, and they told me I could call her Mum now if I wanted to. And I thought, oh, I see, I had to use her name before because they weren't married. You fill in the gaps when you're a child, don't you, with your own weird logic. I was 7 or 8 when a girl at school said to me, That's not your real Mum. Your real Mum disappeared. It sounded mad. I didn't ask Dad or Sin about it, I just locked it away. But I think, on some deep level, I sensed I'd just been handed the answer to some of the strange things I'd noticed, and never been given answers to. I was 11 when I found out properly. By then I'd heard other things from other kids at school. Your real mum ran away was one of them. Then one day, this really poisonous boy said to me, "Your mum was killed by a man who cut off her head." I went home and told my father what that boy had said. I wanted him to laugh, to say it was ridiculous, what a horrible little boy. But he turned white. That same evening, he and Cynthia called me downstairs out of my bedroom, sat me down in the sitting room, and told me the truth. "And everything I thought I knew crumbled away," said Anna quietly. "Who thinks something like this has happened in their own family? I adored Sin. I got on better with her than with my father, to tell you the truth. And then I found out that she wasn't my mum at all, and that they'd both lied. Lied, in fact. Lied by omission. They told me my mother walked out of her GP's practice one night and vanished. The last person to see her alive was the receptionist. She said she was off to the pub, which was 5 minutes up the road. Her best friend was waiting there. When my mother didn't turn up, the friend, Una Kennedy, who'd waited an hour, thought she must have forgotten. She called my parents' house. My mother wasn't there. My father called the practice, but it was closed. It got dark. My mother didn't come home. My father called the police. They investigated for months and months. Nothing. No clues, no sightings. At least, that's what my father and Sin said. But I've since read things that contradict that. I asked Dad and Sin where my mother's parents were. They said they were dead. But that turned out to be true. My grandfather died of a heart attack a couple of years after my mother disappeared, and my grandmother died of a stroke a year later. My mother was an only child, so there were no other relatives I could meet or talk to about her. I asked for photographs. My father said he'd got rid of them all. But Sin dug some out for me a couple of weeks after I found out. She asked me not to tell my father she'd done it, to hide them. I did. I had a pajama case shaped like a rabbit, and I kept my mother's photographs in there for years.
"Did your father and stepmother explain to you what might have happened to your mother?" Strike asked.
"Dennis Creed, you mean?" said Anna. "Yes, but they didn't tell me details. They said there was a chance she'd been killed by a bad man. They had to tell me that much because of what the boy at school had said. It was an appalling idea, thinking she might have been killed by Creed. I found out his name soon enough. Kids at school were happy to fill me in. I started having nightmares about her, headless. Sometimes she came into my bedroom at night. Sometimes I dreamed I found her head in my toy chest. I got really angry with my father and Sin," said Anna, twisting her fingers together. "Angry that they'd never told me, obviously, but I also started wondering what else they were hiding, whether they were involved in my mother disappearing, whether they'd wanted her out of the way so they could marry. I went a bit off the rails, started playing truant. One weekend I took off and was brought home by the police. My father was livid. Of course, I looked back, and after what had happened to my mother, obviously me going missing, even for a few hours, I gave them hell, to tell you the truth," said Anna shamefacedly. "But all credit to Sin, she stuck by me. She never gave up. She and Dad had had kids together by then. I've got a younger brother and sister. And there was family therapy and holidays with bonding activities, all led by Sin, because my father certainly didn't want to do it. The subject of my mother just makes him angry and aggrieved. I remember him yelling at me, 'Didn't I realize how terrible it was for him to have it all dragged up again? How did I think he felt?' When I was 15, I tried to find my mother's friend, Una, the one she was supposed to be meeting the night she disappeared. They were bunny girls together," said Anna with a little smile. "But I didn't know that at the time. I tracked Una down in Wolverhampton, and she was quite emotional to hear from me. We had a couple of lovely phone calls. She told me things I really wanted to know about my mother's sense of humour, the perfume she wore, Rive Gauche. I went out and blew my birthday money on a bottle the next day. How she was addicted to chocolate and was an obsessive Joni Mitchell fan. My mother came more alive to me when I was talking to Una than through the photographs or anything Dad or Sin had told me. But my father found out I'd spoken to Una, and he was furious. He made me give him Una's number and called her and accused her of encouraging me to defy him, told her I was troubled in therapy, and what I didn't need was people stirring. He told me not to wear the Reeve Gauche either. He said he couldn't stand the smell of it. So I never did meet Una, and when I tried to reconnect with her in my 20s, I couldn't find her. She might have passed away for all I know. I got into university, left home, and started reading everything I could about Dennis Creed. The nightmares came back, but it didn't get me any closer to finding out what really happened. Apparently, the man in charge of the investigation into my mother's disappearance, a detective inspector called Bill Talbot, always thought Creed took her. Talbot will be dead by now. He was coming up for retirement anyway. Then, a few years out of uni, I had the bright idea of starting a website, said Anna. My girlfriend at the time was tech-savvy. She helped me set it up. I was very naive, she sighed. I said who I was and begged for information about my mother. You can probably imagine what happened. All kinds of theories. Psychics telling me where to dig, people telling me my father had obviously done it, others telling me I wasn't really Margot's daughter, that I was after money and publicity, and some really malicious messages as well, saying my mother had probably run off with a lover and worse. A couple of journalists got in touch too. One of them ran an awful piece in the Daily Express about our family. They contacted my father, and that was just about the final nail in the coffin for our relationship. It's never really recovered, said Anna bleakly. When I told him I'm gay, he seemed to think I was only doing it to spite him. And Sin's gone over to his side a bit these last few years. She always says, I've got a loyalty to your dad too, Anna. So, said Anna, that's where we are. There was a brief silence. Dreadful for you, said Robin. It is, agreed Kim, placing her hand on Anna's knee again. And I'm wholly sympathetic to Anna's desire for resolution. Of course I am. But is it realistic? She said, looking from Robin to Strike. And I mean this with no offence to you two, to think that you'll achieve what the police haven't after all this time. Realistic? Said Strike. No. Robin noticed Anna's downward look and the sudden rush of tears into her large eyes. She felt desperately sorry for the older woman, but at the same time she respected Strike's honesty, and it seemed to have impressed the sceptical Kim, too. Here's the truth, Strike said, tactfully looking at his notes until Anna had finished drying her eyes with the back of her hand. I think we'd have a reasonable chance of getting hold of the old police foil because we've got decent contacts at the Met. We can sift right through the evidence again, revisit witnesses as far as that's possible, basically make sure every stone's been turned over twice. But it's odds on that after all this time we wouldn't find any more than the police did, and we'd be facing two major obstacles. First, zero forensic evidence. From what I understand, literally no trace of your mother was ever found, is that right? No items of clothing, bus pass, nothing.
True, mumbled Anna.
Secondly, as you've just pointed out, a lot of the people connected with her or who witnessed anything that night are likely to have died.
I know, said Anna, and a tear trickled, sparkling down her nose onto the Perspex table.
Kim reached out and put an arm around her shoulders.
Maybe it's turning 40, said Anna with a sob. But I can't stand the idea that I'll go to my grave never knowing what happened.
I understand that, said Strike. But I don't want to promise what I'm unlikely to be able to deliver.
Have there, asked Robin, been any new leads or developments over the years?
Kim answered. She seemed a little shaken by Anna's naked distress and kept her arm around her shoulders.
Not as far as we know, do we, Annie? But any information of that kind would probably have gone to Roy, Anna's father,
And he might not have told us.
He acts as though none of this ever happened. It's how he copes, said Anna, wiping her tears away. He pretends my mother never existed, except for the inconvenient fact that if she hadn't, I wouldn't be here. Believe it or not, she said, it's the possibility that she just went away of her own accord and never came back, never wanted to see how I was doing, or let us know where she was, that really haunts me. That's the thing I can't bear to contemplate. My grandmother on my father's side, who I never loved, she was one of the meanest women I've ever met, took it upon herself to tell me that it had always been her private belief that my mother had simply run away, that she didn't like being a wife and a mother. That hurt me more than I can tell you. The thought that my mother would let everyone go through the horror of wondering what had happened to her and never check that her daughter was all right. Even if Dennis Creed killed her, said Anna, it would be terrible, awful. But it would be over. I could mourn rather than live with a possibility that she's out there somewhere, living under a different name, not caring what happened to us all. There was a brief silence, in which both Strike and Robin drank coffee. Anna sniffed, and Kim left the sofa area to tear off kitchen roll, which she handed to her wife. A second ragdoll cat entered the room. She subjected the four humans to a supercilious glare before lying down and stretching in a patch of sunlight. "That's Lacey," said Kim, while Anna mopped her face. "She doesn't really like anyone, even us." Strike and Robin laughed politely again.
"How would this work?" asked Kim abruptly. "How do you charge?"
"By the hour," said Strike. "You get an itemized monthly bill. I can email you our rates," he offered. "But I'd imagine you two will want to talk this over properly before coming to a decision."
"Yes, definitely," said Kim. But as she gave Strike her email address, she looked with concern again at Anna, who was sitting with head bowed, still pressing kitchen roll to her eyes at regular intervals. Strike Stump protested at being asked to support his weight again so soon after sitting down, but there seemed little more to discuss, especially as Anna had regressed into a tearful silence. Slightly regretting the untouched plate of biscuits, the detective shook Anna's cool hand.
"Thanks anyway," she said.
And he had the feeling that he had disappointed her, that she'd hoped he would make her a promise of the truth, that he would swear upon his honour to do what everyone else had failed to do. Kim showed them out of the house. "We'll call you later," she said. "This afternoon. Will that be all right?"
"Great. We'll wait to hear from you," said Strike.
Robin glanced back as she and Strike headed down the sunlit garden steps towards the street, and caught Kim giving them a strange look, as though she'd found something in the pair of visitors that she hadn't expected. Catching Robin's eye, she smiled reflexively and closed the blue door behind them. Chapter 7. Long they thus travelled in friendly wise, through country's waste and eke well edified. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. As they headed out of Falmouth, Strike's mood turned to cheerfulness, which Robin attributed mainly to the interest of a possible new case. She'd never yet known an intriguing problem to fail to engage his attention, no matter what might be happening in his private life. She was partially right. Strike's interest had certainly been piqued by Anna's story, but he was mainly cheered by the prospect of keeping weight off his prosthesis for a few hours, and by the knowledge that every passing minute put further distance between himself and his sister. Opening the car window, allowing the familiar sea air to rush bracingly inside the old car, he lit a cigarette and, blowing smoke away from Robin, asked,
"See much of Morris while I've been away?"
"Saw him yesterday," said Robin. "Paid him for his month's expenses."
"Ah, great, cheers," said Strike. "I meant to remind you that needed doing. What do you think of him? Barclay says he's good at the job, except he talks too much in the car."
"Yeah," said Robin noncommittally. "He does like to talk."
"'Hutchins thinks he's a bit smarmy,' said Strike, subtly probing. He'd noticed the special tone Morris reserved for Robin. Hutchins also reported that Morris had asked him what Robin's relationship status was. Said Robin. "'Well, I haven't really had enough contact with him to form an opinion.' Given Strike's current stress levels and the amount of work the agency was struggling to cover, she decided not to criticize his most recent hire. They needed an extra man. At least Morris was good at the job. "'Pat likes him,' she added, partly out of mischief, and was amused to see, out of the corner of her eye, Strike turn to look at her, scowling.
"'That's no bloody recommendation.'
"'Unkind,' said Robin.
"'You realize in a week's time it's going to be harder to sack her. Her probation period's nearly up.'
"'I don't want to sack her,' said Robin. "'I think she's great.'
"'Well, then, on your head be it if she causes trouble down the line.'
"'It won't be on my head,' said Robin. "'You're not pinning Pat on me. Hiring her was a joint decision. You were the one who was sick of temps, and you were the one who said it might not be a bad idea to get a more traditional manager in,
and we shouldn't discount her because of her age.
I know what I said, and I stand by the age thing.' We do need someone who understands a spreadsheet, who's organised. But you were the one who...
I didn't want you accusing me of ageism. You were the one who offered her the job.
Robin finished firmly.
Dunno what I was bloody thinking,
muttered Strike, flicking ash out of the window. Patricia Chauncey was 56 and looked 65. A thin woman with a deeply lined monkeyish face and implausibly jet-black hair. She vaped continually in the office, but was to be seen drawing deeply on a Super King the moment her feet touched the pavement at the end of the day's work. Pat's voice was so deep and rasping that she was often mistaken for Strike on the phone. She sat at what once had been Robin's desk in the outer office and had taken over the bulk of the agency's phone answering and administrative duties now that Robin had moved to full-time detection. Strike and Pat's relationship had been combative from the start, which puzzled Robin, who liked them both. Robin was used to Strike's intermittent bouts of moodiness and prone to give him the benefit of the doubt, especially when she suspected he was in pain. But Pat had no compunction about snapping,
"Would a thanks kill you?"
if Strike showed insufficient gratitude when she passed him his phone messages. She evidently felt none of the reverence some of their temps had displayed towards the now famous detective, one of whom had been sacked on the spot, when Strike realized she was surreptitiously filming him on her mobile from the outer office. Indeed, the office manager's demeanor suggested that she lived in daily expectation of finding out things to Strike's discredit, and she displayed a certain satisfaction on hearing that the dent in one of the filing cabinets was due to the fact that he'd once punched it. On the other hand, the filing was up to date, the accounts were in order, all receipts were neatly docketed, the phone was answered promptly, messages were passed on accurately, they never ran out of tea bags or milk, and Pat had never once arrived late, no matter the weather, and irrespective of tube delays. It was true, too, that Pat liked Morris, who was the recipient of most of her rare smiles. Morris was always careful to pay Pat his full tribute of blue-eyed charm before turning his attention to Robin. Pat was already alert to the possibility of romance between her younger colleagues.
"'He's lovely-looking,'
she told Robin just the previous week, after Morris had phoned in his location so that the temporarily unreachable Barclay could be told where to take over surveillance on their biggest case.
"'You've got to give him that.'
"'I haven't got to give him anything,' Robin had said, a little crossly. It was bad enough having Isla badger her about Strike in her leisure time, without Pat starting on Morris during her working hours.
"'Quite right.'
Pat had responded, unfazed.
"'Make him earn it.'
"'Anyway,' said Strike, finishing his cigarette and crushing the stub out in the tin Robin kept for that purpose in the glove compartment, "'you've wrapped up Tufty. Bloody good going.'
"'Thanks,' Robin said. "'But there's going to be press. Bigham is always news.'
"'Yeah,' said Strike. "'Well, it's going to be worse for him than us, but it's worth trying to keep our name out of it if we can.' I'll have a word with Mrs. Campion in Windsor. So that leaves us,
he counted the names on his thick fingers,
with Two Times, Twinkle Toes, Postcard and Shifty.
It had become the agency's habit to assign nicknames to their targets and clients, mainly to avoid letting real names slip in public or in emails. Two Times was a previous client of the agency who'd recently resurfaced after trying other private detectives and finding them unsatisfactory. Strike and Robin had previously investigated two of his girlfriends. At a superficial glance, he seemed most unlucky in love. A man whose partners, initially attracted by his fat bank balance, seemed incapable of fidelity. Over time, Strike and Robin had come to believe that he derived obscure emotional or sexual satisfaction from being cheated on, and that they were being paid to provide evidence that, far from upsetting him, gave him pleasure. Once confronted with photographic evidence of her perfidy, the girlfriend of the moment would be confronted, dismissed, and another found, and the whole pattern repeated. This time round, he was dating a glamour model who, thus far, to Two Times' poorly concealed disappointment, seemed to be faithful. Twinkle Toes, whose unimaginative nickname had been chosen by Morris, was a 24-year-old dancer who was currently having an affair with a 39-year-old double divorcee, notable mainly for her history of drug abuse and her enormous trust fund. The socialite's father was employing the agency to discover anything they could about Twinkle Toes' background or behaviour which could be used to prise his daughter away from him. Postcard was, so far, an entirely unknown quantity. A middle-aged and, in Robin's opinion, fairly unattractive television weather forecaster had come to the agency after the police had said there was nothing they could do about the postcards that had begun to arrive at his place of work and, most worryingly, hand-delivered to his house in the small hours. The cards made no threats. Indeed, they were often no more than banal comments on the weatherman's choice of tie. Yet they gave evidence of knowing far more about the man's movements and private life than a stranger should have. The use of postcards was also a peculiar choice when persecution was so much easier these days online. The agency's subcontractor, Andy Hutchins, had now spent 2 solid weeks' worth of nights parked outside the weatherman's house, but Postcard hadn't yet shown themselves. Last and most lucrative was the interesting case of Shifty, a young investment banker whose rapid rise through his company had generated a predictable amount of resentment among overlooked colleagues, which had exploded into full-blown suspicion when he'd been promoted to the second-in-command job ahead of 3 undeniably better qualified candidates. Exactly what leverage Shifty had on the CEO, known to the agency as Shifty's Boss, or SB, was now a matter of interest not only to Shifty's subordinates, but to a couple of suspicious board members who'd met Strike in a dark bar in the city to lay out their concerns. Strike's current strategy was to try to find out more about Shifty through his personal assistant, and to this end, Morris had been given the job of chatting her up after hours, revealing neither his real name nor his occupation, but trying to gauge how deep her loyalty to Shifty ran.
"Do you need to be back in London by any particular time?" Strike asked, after a brief silence.
"No," said Robin. "Why?"
"Would you mind," said Strike, "if we stopped for food? I didn't have breakfast."
Despite remembering that he had, in fact, had a plateful of croissant crumbs in front of him when she arrived at the Palacio Lounge, Robin agreed. Strike seemed to read her mind.
"You can't count a croissant. Mostly air."
Robin laughed. By the time they reached Subway at Cornwall Services, the atmosphere between the two of them had become almost light-hearted, notwithstanding their tiredness. Once Robin, mindful of her resolution to eat more healthily, had started on her salad, and Strike had taken a few satisfying mouthfuls of his steak and cheese sandwich, he emailed Kim Sullivan their form letter about billing clients, then said,
"I had a row with Lucy this morning."
Robin surmised that it must have been a bad one for Strike to mention it.
5 o'clock in the garden, while I was having a quiet smoke.
"Bit early for conflict," said Robin, picking unenthusiastically through lettuce leaves.
"Well, it turns out we're competing in the Who Loves Joan Best Handicap Stakes. Didn't even know I'd been entered."
He ate in silence for a minute, then went on.
It ended with me telling her I thought Adam's a whiny prick and Luke's an arsehole.
Robin, who'd been sipping her water, inhaled and was seized by a paroxysm of coughs. Diners at nearby tables glanced round as Robin spluttered and gasped. Grabbing a paper napkin from the table to mop her chin and her streaming eyes, she wheezed,
"What on earth did you say that for?"
"Because Adam's a whiny prick and Luke's an arsehole."
Still trying to cough water out of her windpipe, Robin laughed, eyes streaming, but shook her head.
"Bloody hell, Cormoran,"
she said, when at last she could talk properly.
"You haven't just had a solid week of them. Luke broke my new headphones, then ran off with my leg, the little shit. Then Lucy accuses me of favouring Jack. Of course I favour him. He's the only decent one."
"Yes, but telling their mother..."
"Yeah, I know," said Strike heavily. "I'll ring and apologise."
There was a brief pause.
"But for fuck's sake," he growled, "why do I have to take all three of them out together? Neither of the others give a toss about the military." "Adam cried when you came back from the war rooms, my arse. The little bastard didn't like that I bought Jack stuff, that's all. If Lucy had her way, I'd be taking them on group outings every weekend, and they'd take turns to choose. It'll be the zoo and effing go-karting and everything that was good about me seeing Jack'll be ruined." "I like Jack," said Strike, with what appeared to be surprise. "We're interested in the same stuff. What's with this mania for treating them all the same? Useful life lesson, I'd have thought, realising you aren't old. You don't get stuff automatically because of who you're related to. But fine. She wants me to buy the other two presents?"
And he framed a square in midair with his hands.
"Try not being a little shit. I'll get that made up as a plaque for Luke's bedroom wall."
They bought a bag of snacks, then resumed their drive. As they turned out onto the road again, Strike expressed his guilt that he couldn't share the driving, because the old Land Rover was too much of a challenge with his false leg.
"It doesn't matter," said Robin. "I don't mind. What's funny?"
she added, seeing Strike smirking at something he had found in their bag of food.
"English strawberries," he said.
"And that's comical. Why?"
He explained about Dave Polwarth's fury that goods of Cornish origin weren't labelled as such, and his commensurate glee that more and more locals were putting their Cornish identity above English on forms.
"Social identity theory is very interesting," said Robin. "That and self-categorization theory. I studied them at uni. There are implications for businesses as well as society, you know."
She talked happily for a couple of minutes before realizing, on glancing sideways, that Strike had fallen fast asleep. Choosing not to take offense because he looked grey with tiredness, Robin fell silent, and other than the occasional grunting snore, there was no more communication to be had from Strike until, on the outskirts of Swindon, he suddenly jerked awake again.
"Shite," he said, wiping his mouth with the back of his hand. "Sorry. How long was I asleep?"
"About 3 hours," said Robin.
"Shit," he said again. "Sorry,"
and immediately reached for a cigarette.
"I've been kipping on the world's most uncomfortable sofa, and the kids have woken me up at a crack of fucking dawn every day. Want anything from the food bag?"
"Yes," said Robin, throwing the diet to the winds. She was in urgent need of a pick-me-up. "Chocolate, English or Cornish, I don't mind."
"Sorry," Strike said for a third time. "You were telling me about a social theory or something."
Robin grinned.
"You fell asleep around the time I was telling you my fascinating application of social identity theory to detective practice."
"Which is?" he said,
trying to make up in politeness now what he had lost earlier. Robin, who knew perfectly well that this was why he had asked the question, said,
"In essence, we tend to sort each other and ourselves into groupings, and that usually leads to an overestimation of similarities between members of a group, and an underestimation of the similarities between insiders and outsiders."
"So you're saying all Cornishmen aren't rugged salt-of-the-earthers, and all Englishmen aren't pompous arseholes?"
Strike unwrapped a Yorkie and put it into her hand.
Sounds unlikely, but I'll run it past Polwarth next time we meet.
Ignoring the strawberries, which had been Robin's purchase, Strike opened a can of Coke and drank it while smoking and watching the sky turn bloody as they drew nearer to London.
"Dennis Creed's still alive, you know," said Strike, watching trees blur out of the window. "I was reading about him online this morning."
"Where is he?"
asked Robin.
"Broadmoor," said Strike. "He went to Wakefield initially, then Belmarsh, and was transferred to Broadmoor in 95.
"What was the psychiatric diagnosis?"
"Controversial. Psychiatrists disagreed about whether or not he was sane at his trial. Very high IQ. In the end, the jury decided he was capable of knowing what he was doing was wrong, hence prison, not hospital. But he must have developed symptoms since that to justify medical treatment." "On a very small amount of reading," Strike went on, "I can see why the lead investigator thought Margot Bamborough might have been one of Creed's victims. Allegedly, there was a small van seen speeding dangerously in the area, around the time she should have been walking towards the Three Kings. Creed used a van," Strike elucidated, in response to Robin's questioning look, "in some of the other known abductions."
The lamps along the motorway had been lit before Robin, having finished her Yorkie, quoted, "She lies in a holy place." Still smoking, Strike snorted.
"Typical medium bollocks."
"You think?"
"Yes, I bloody think," said Strike. "Very convenient, the way people could only speak in crossword clues from the afterlife. Come off it."
"All right, calm down. I was only thinking out loud."
"You could spin almost anywhere as a holy place if you wanted. Clerkenwell, where she disappeared. That whole area's got some kind of religious connection. Monks or something. Know where Dennis Creed was living in 1974?
"Go on."
"Paradise Park, Islington," said Strike.
"Oh," said Robin. "So you think the medium did know who Anna's mother was?"
"If I was in the medium game, I'd sure as hell Google clients' names before they showed up. But it could have been a fancy touch designed to sound comforting, like Anna said. Hints at a decent burial. However bad her end was, it's purified by where her remains are. Creed admitted to scattering bone fragments in Paradise Park, by the way. Stamped them into the flower beds."
Although the car was still stuffy, Robin felt a small involuntary shudder run through her.
"Fucking ghouls," said Strike.
"Who?"
"Mediums, psychics, all those shysters, preying on people."
"You don't think some of them believe in what they're doing? Think they really are getting messages from the beyond?"
"I think there are a lot of nutters in the world, and the less we reward them for their nuttery, the better for all of us."
The mobile rang in Strike's pocket. He pulled it out.
"Cormoran Strike?"
"Yes, hello. It's Anna Phipps. I've got Kim here too."
Strike turned the mobile to speakerphone.
"Hope you can hear us all right," he said,
over the rumble and rattle of the Land Rover. "We're still in the car."
"Yes, it is noisy," said Anna.
"I'll pull over," said Robin, and she did so, turning smoothly onto the hard shoulder.
"Oh, that's better," said Anna, as Robin turned off the engine. "Well, Kim and I have talked it over, and we've decided we would like to hire you."
Robin felt a jolt of excitement.
"Great," said Strike. "We're very keen to help if we can."
"But," said Kim, "we feel that for psychological and, well, candidly, financial reasons, we'd like to set a term on the investigation, because if the police haven't solved this case in nigh on 40 years, I mean, you could be looking for the next 40 and find nothing."
"That's true," said Strike. "So?"
"We think a year," said Anna, sounding nervous. What do you... Does that seem reasonable?"
"It's what I would have suggested," said Strike. "To be honest, I don't think we've got much chance in anything under 12 months.
"Is there anything more you need from me to get started?"
Anna asked, sounding both nervous and excited.
"I'm sure something will occur to me," said Strike, taking out his notebook to check a name. "But it would be good to speak to your father and Cynthia."
The other end of the line became completely silent. Strike and Robin looked at each other.
"I don't think there's any chance of that," said Anna. "I'm sorry, but if my father knew I was doing this, I doubt he'd ever forgive me."
"And what about Cynthia?"
"The thing is," came Kim's voice, "Anna's father's been unwell recently. Cynthia is the more reasonable of the two on this subject, but she won't want anything to upset Roy just now."
"Well, no problem," said Strike, raising his eyebrows at Robin. "Our first priority's got to be getting hold of the police file. In the meantime, I'll email you one of our standard contracts. Print it out, sign it, and send it back. We'll get going."
"Thank you," said Anna. And with a slight delay, Kim said, "Okay, then." They hung up.
"Well, well," said Strike. "Our first cold case. This is going to be interesting."
"And we've got a year," said Robin, pulling back out onto the motorway.
"They'll extend that if we look as though we're onto something," said Strike.
"Good luck with that," said Robin sardonically. "Kim's prepared to give us a year so she can tell Anna they've tried everything. I'll bet you a fiver right now we don't get any extensions."
"I'll take that bet," said Strike. "If there's a hint of a lead, Anna's going to want to see it through to the end."
The remainder of the journey was spent discussing the agency's four current investigations, a conversation that took them all the way to the top of Denmark Street, where Strike got out.
"Cormoran," said Robin, as he lifted the holdall out of the back of the Land Rover, "there's a message on your desk from Charlotte Campbell. She called the day before yesterday and asked you to ring her back. She said she's got something you want."
There was a brief moment where Strike simply looked at Robin, his expression unreadable.
"Right, thanks. Well, I'll see you tomorrow."
"No, I won't,"
he instantly contradicted himself. "You've got time off. Enjoy." And with a slam of the rear door, he limped off towards the office, head down, carrying his holdall over his shoulder, leaving an exhausted Robin no wiser as to whether he did or didn't want whatever it was that Charlotte Campbell had. Part 2. Then came the autumn, all in yellow clad. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. Chapter 8. Full dreadful things out of that baleful book he read. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. When Strike and Robin broke the news of her husband's bigamy, the white-faced woman they now call the second Mrs. Tufty had sat in silence for a couple of minutes. Her small but charming house in central Windsor was quiet that Tuesday morning, her son and daughter at primary school, and she'd cleaned before they arrived. There was a smell of pledge in the air and hoover marks on the carpet. Upon the highly polished coffee table lay 10 photographs of Tufty in Torquay, minus his toupee, laughing as he walked out of the pizza restaurant with the teenage boys who so strongly resembled the young children he'd fathered in Windsor, his arm around a smiling woman who might have been their client's older sister. Robin, who could remember exactly how she'd felt when Sarah Shadlock's diamond earring had fallen out of her own marital bed, could only guess at the scale of pain, humiliation, and shame behind the taut face. Strike was speaking conventional words of sympathy, but Robin would have bet her entire bank account that Mrs. Tufty hadn't heard a word, and knew she'd been right when Mrs. Tufty suddenly stood up, shaking so badly that Strike also struggled to his feet mid-sentence in case she needed catching. However, she walked jerkily past him out of the room. Shortly afterwards, they heard the front door open and spotted their client through the net curtain, approaching a red Audi Q3 parked in front of the house with a golf club in her hand.
"Oh, shit," said Robin.
By the time they reached her, the second Mrs. Tufty had smashed the windscreen and put several deep dents in the roof of the car. Gawping neighbours had appeared at windows, and a pair of Pomeranians were yapping frenziedly behind glass in the house opposite. When Strike grabbed the 4-iron out of her hand, Mrs. Tufty swore at him, tried to wrestle it back,
then burst into a storm of tears. Robin put her arm around their client and steered her firmly back into the house, Strike bringing up the rear, holding the golf club. In the kitchen, Robin instructed Strike to make strong coffee and find brandy. On Robin's advice, Mrs. Tufty called her brother and begged him to come quickly. But when she'd hung up and begun scrolling to find Tufty's number, Robin jerked the mobile out of her well-manicured hand.
"Give it back!" said Mrs. Tufty,
wild-eyed and ready to fight.
"The bastard! The bastard! I want to talk to him! Give it back!"
"Bad idea," said Strike, putting coffee and brandy in front of her. "He's already proven he's adept at hiding money and assets from you. You need a shit-hot lawyer."
They remained with the client until her brother, a suited HR executive, arrived. He was annoyed that he'd been asked to leave work early, and so slow at grasping what he was being told that Strike became almost irate, and Robin felt it necessary to intervene to stop a row.
"Fuck's sake," muttered Strike, as they drove back towards London. "He was already married to someone else when he married your sister. How hard is that to grasp?"
"Very hard," said Robin, an edge to her voice. "People don't expect to find themselves in these kind of situations."
"Do you think they heard me when I asked them not to tell the press we were involved?"
"No," said Robin. She was right. A fortnight after they'd visited Windsor, they woke to find several tabloids carrying front-page exposés of Tufty and his three women, a picture of Strike in all the inside pages, and his name in one of the headlines. He was news in his own right now, and the juxtaposition of famous detective and squat, balding, wealthy man who'd managed to run two families and a mistress was irresistible. Strike had only ever given evidence at noteworthy court cases while sporting the full beard that grew conveniently fast when he needed it, and the picture the press used most often was an old one that showed him in uniform. Nevertheless, it was an ongoing battle to remain as inconspicuous as his chosen profession demanded, and being badgered for comment at his offices was an inconvenience he could do without. The storm of publicity was prolonged when both Mrs. Tufties formed an offensive alliance against their estranged husband. Showing an unforeseen taste for publicity, they not only granted a woman's magazine a joint interview, but appeared on several daytime television programs together to discuss their long deception, their shock, their newfound friendship, their intention to make Tufty rue the day he'd met either of them, and to issue a thinly veiled warning to the pregnant mistress in Glasgow, who, astonishingly, seemed disposed to stand by Tufty, that she had another think coming if she imagined he'd have two farthings to rub together once his wives had finished with him. September proceeded, cool and unsettled. Strike called Lucy to say sorry for being rude about her sons, but she remained cold even after the apology, doubtless because he'd merely expressed regret for voicing his opinion out loud and hadn't retracted it. Strike was relieved to discover that her boys had weekend sporting fixtures now that school had started again, which meant he didn't have to sleep on the sofa on the next visit to St. Maur's, and could devote himself to Ted and Joan without the distraction of Lucy's tense, accusatory presence. Though as desperate to cook for him as ever, his aunt was already enfeebled by the chemotherapy. It was painful to watch her dragging herself around the kitchen, but she wouldn't sit down, even when Ted implored her to do so. On Saturday night, his uncle broke down after Joan had gone to bed and sobbed into Strike's shoulder. Ted had once seemed an unperturbable, invulnerable bastion of strength to his nephew, and Strike, who could normally sleep under almost any conditions, lay awake past 2 in the morning, staring into the darkness that was deeper by far than a London night, wondering whether he should stay longer, and despising himself for deciding that it was right that he should return to London. In truth, the agency was so busy that he felt guilty about the burden it was placing on Robin and his subcontractors by taking a long weekend in Cornwall. In addition to the 5 open cases still on the agency's books, he and Robin were juggling increased management demands made by the expanded workforce and negotiating a year's extension on the office lease with the developer who'd bought their building.
They were also trying, though so far without luck, to persuade one of the agency's police contacts to find and hand over the 40-year-old file on Margot Bamborough's disappearance. Morris was ex-Met, as was Andy Hutchins, their most long-standing subcontractor, a quiet, saturnine man whose MS was thankfully in remission, and both had tried to call in favours from former colleagues as well. But so far, responses to the agency's requests had ranged from "Mice have probably had it," to "Fuck off strike, I'm busy." One rainy afternoon, while tailing shifty through the city, trying not to limp too obviously, and inwardly cursing the second pavement seller of cheap umbrellas who got in his way, Strike's mobile rang. Expecting to be given another problem to sort out, he was caught off guard when the caller said, "Hi, Strike, George Laybourne here. Heard you're looking at the Bamborough case again." Strike had only met D.I. Laybourne once before, and while it had been in the context of a case where Strike and Robin had given material assistance to the Met, he hadn't considered their association close enough to ask Laybourne for help on getting the Bamborough file.
"Hi, George."
"Yeah, you heard right," said Strike, watching Shifty turn into a wine bar. "Well, I could meet you tomorrow evening if you fancy it. Feathers, 6 o'clock," said Laybourne. So Strike asked Barclay to swap jobs and headed to the pub near Scotland Yard the following evening, where he found Laybourne already at the bar waiting for him. A paunchy, grey-haired, middle-aged man, Laybourne bought both of them pints of London Pride, and they removed themselves to a corner table. "My old man worked the Bamborough case under Bill Talbot," Laybourne told Strike. "He told me all about it. What have you got so far?"
"Nothing. I've been looking back at old press reports, and I'm trying to trace people who worked at the practice she disappeared from. Not much else I can do until I see the police file, but nobody's been able to help with that so far."
Laybourne, who had demonstrated a fondness for colourfully obscene turns of phrase on their only previous encounter, seemed oddly subdued tonight.
"It was a fucking mess, the Bamborough investigation," he said quietly.
"Anyone told you about Talbot yet?"
"Go on."
"He went off his rocker," said Laybourne. "Proper mental breakdown. He'd been going funny before he took on the case. But you know, it was the '70s. Looking after the workforce's mental health was for puffs. He'd been a good officer in his day, mind you. A couple of junior officers noticed he was acting odd, but when they raised it, they were told to F off. He'd been heading up the Bamborough case 6 months before his wife called an ambulance in the middle of the night and got him sectioned. He got his pension, but it was too late for the case. He died a good 10 years ago. But I heard he never got over fucking up the investigation. Once he recovered, he was mortified about how he behaved."
"How was that?"
"Putting too much stock in his own intuitions. Didn't take evidence properly. Had no interest in talking to witnesses if they didn't fit his theory."
"Which was that Creed abducted her, right?"
"Exactly," said Laybourne. "Although Creed was still called the Essex Butcher back then, because he dumped the first couple of bodies in Epping Forest and Chigwell." Laybourne took a long pull on his pint. "They found most of Jackie Ayler in an industrial bin. He's an animal, that one. Animal."
"Who took over the case after Talbot?"
"Bloke called Lawson. Ken Lawson," said Laybourne. "But he'd lost 6 months, the trail had gone cold, and he'd inherited a right balls up. Added to which, he was unlucky in her timing. Margot Bamborough," Laybourne continued. "You know what happened a month after she vanished?"
"What?"
"Lord Lucan disappeared," said Laybourne. "You try and keep a missing GP on the front pages after a peer at a realm's nanny gets bludgeoned to death and he goes on the run. They'd already used the bunny girl pictures. Did you know Bamborough was a bunny girl?"
"Yeah," said Strike.
"Help fund her medical degree," said Laybourne. "But according to my old man, the family didn't like that being dragged up, put their backs right up, even though those pictures definitely got the case a bit more coverage. Way of the world, he said, isn't it?"
"What did your dad think happened to her?" asked Strike.
"Well, to be honest," sighed Laybourne, "he thought Talbot was probably right. Creed had taken her. There were no signs she meant to disappear. Passport was still in the house, no case packed, no clothes missing, stable job, no money worries, young child. Hard to drag a fit, healthy 29-year-old woman up a busy street without someone noticing," said Strike.
True, said Leybourne. Creed usually picked them off when they were drunk. Having said that, it was a dark evening and rainy. He pulled that trick before, and he was good at lulling women's suspicions and getting their sympathy. A couple of them walked into his flat of their own accord. There was a van like Creed seen speeding in the area, wasn't there?
Yeah, said Leybourne.
And from what Dad told me, it was never checked out properly. Talbot didn't want to hear that it might have been someone trying to get home for their tea, see? Routine work just wasn't done. For instance, I heard there was an old boyfriend of Bambury's hanging around. I'm not saying the boyfriend killed her, but Dad told me Talbot spent half the interview trying to find out where this boyfriend had been on the night Helen Wardrop got attacked.
Who?
Prostitute. Creed tried to abduct her in 73. He had his failures, you know. Peggy Hiskett, she got away from him and gave the police a description in 71, but that didn't help him much. She said he was dark and stocky because he was wearing a wig at the time and all padded out in a woman's coat. They caught him in the end because of Melody Bauer. Nightclub singer, looked like Diana Ross. Creed got chatting to her at a bus stop, offered her a lift, then tried to drag her into the van when she said no. She escaped, gave the police a proper description and told them he'd said his house was off Paradise Park. He got careless towards the end. Arrogance did for him.
You know a lot about this, George.
Yeah, well, Dad was one of the first at the Creed's basement after they arrested him. He wouldn't ever talk about what he saw in there, and he'd seen gangland killings, you name it. Creed's never admitted to Bamborough, but that doesn't mean he didn't do it. That cunt will keep people guessing till he's dead, evil fucking bastard. He's played with the families of his known victims for years. Likes hinting he did more women without giving any details. Some journalist interviewed him in the early 80s, but that was the last time they let anyone talk to him. The Ministry of Justice clamped down. Creed uses publicity as a chance to torment the families. It's the only power he's got left. Leybourne drained the last of his pint and checked his watch. I'll do what I can for you with a file. My old man would have wanted me to help. It never sat right with him. What happened with that case? The wind was picking up by the time Strike returned to his attic flat. His rain-speckled windows rattled in their loose frames as he sorted carefully through the receipts in his wallet for those he needed to submit to the accountant. At 9 o'clock, after eating dinner cooked on his single-ringed hob, he lay down in his bed and picked up the second-hand biography of Dennis Creed, The Demon of Paradise Park, which he'd ordered a month ago and which had so far lain unopened on his bedside table. Having undone the button on his trousers to better accommodate the large amount of spaghetti he'd just consumed, he emitted a loud and satisfying belch, lit a cigarette, laid back against his pillows, and opened the book to the beginning, where a timeline laid out the bare bones of Creed's long career of rape and murder. 1937, born in Greenwell Terrace, Mile End. 1954, April, began national service. November, raped schoolgirl Vicky Hornchurch, 15, sentenced to 2 years, Felton Borstal. 1955 to 61, worked in a variety of short-lived manual and office jobs, frequented prostitutes. 1961, July, raped and tortured shop assistant Sheila Gaskins, 22, sentenced to 5 years, HMP Pentonville. 1968, April, abducted, raped, tortured and murdered schoolgirl Geraldine Christie, 16. 1969, September, abducted, raped, tortured and murdered secretary and mother of one, Jackie Aylett, 29. Killer dubbed the Essex Butcher by press. 1970, January. Moved to Vi Hooper's basement in Liverpool Road near Paradise Park. Gained job as dry cleaning delivery man. February. Abducted dinner lady and mother of three, Vera Kenny, 31. Kept in basement for 3 weeks. Raped, tortured, and murdered. November. Abducted estate agent Noreen Sturrock, 28. Kept in basement for 4 weeks. Raped, tortured, and murdered. 1971, August. Failed to abduct pharmacist Peggy Hiskett, 34. 1972, September. Abducted unemployed Gail Reitman, 30. Kept imprisoned in basement. Raped and tortured. 1973,
January, murdered Reitman. December, failed to abduct prostitute and mother of one, Helen Wardrop, 32. 1974, September, abducted hairdresser Susan Mayer, 27. Kept imprisoned in basement, raped and tortured. 1975, February, abducted PhD student Andrea Hooton, 23. Hooton and Mayer were held concurrently in basement for 4 weeks. March, murdered Susan. April, murdered Andrea. 1976, January 25th, attempted to abduct nightclub singer Melody Bauer, 26. January 31st, landlady Vi Hooper recognizes Creed from description and photo fit. February 2nd, Creed arrested. Strike turned over the page and skim-read the introduction, which featured the only interview ever granted by Creed's mother, Agnes Waite. She began by telling me that the date given on Creed's birth certificate was false.
"It says he was born December the 20th, doesn't it?" she asked me. "That's not right. It was the night of November 19th. He lied about it when he registered the birth, because we were outside the time you were supposed to do it."
He was Agnes's stepfather, William Audrey, a man notorious in the local area for his violent temper.
"He took the baby out of my arms as soon as I'd had it, and said he was going to kill it. Drown it in the outside toilet. I begged him not to. I pleaded with him to let the baby live. I hadn't known till then whether I wanted it to live or die. But once you've seen them, held them, and he was strong, Dennis, he wanted to live. You could tell. It went on for weeks, the threats. Audrey threatening to kill him. But by then the neighbours had heard the baby crying and probably heard what Audrey was threatening as well. He knew there was no hiding it. He'd waited too long. So he registered the birth but lied about the date so nobody would ask why he'd done it so late. There wasn't nobody to say it had happened either. Not anybody you count. They never got me a midwife or a nurse or anything."
Creed often wrote me fuller answers than we'd had time for during face-to-face interviews. Months later, he sent me the following concerning his own suspicions about his paternity.
"I saw my supposed step-grandfather looking at me out of the mirror. The resemblance grew stronger as I got older. I had his eyes, the same shaped ears, his sallow complexion, his long neck. He was a bigger man than I was, a more masculine-looking man. And I think part of his great dislike of me came from the fact that he hated to see his own features in a weak and girlish form. He despised vulnerability."
"Yeah, of course Dennis was his," Agnes told me. "He, Audrey, started on me when I was 13. I was never allowed out, never had a boyfriend. When my mother realised I was expecting, Audrey told her I'd been sneaking out to meet someone. What else was he going to say? And Mum believed him, or she pretended to."
Agnes fled her stepfather's overcrowded house shortly before Dennis's second birthday, when she was 16 and a half.
"I wanted to take Dennis with me, but I left in the middle of the night, and I couldn't afford to make noise. I had nowhere to go, no job, no money. Just a boyfriend who said he'd look after me, so I went."
She was to see her firstborn only twice more. When she found out William Audrey was serving 9 months in jail for assault, she returned to her mother's house in hopes of snatching Dennis away.
"I was going to tell Bert, her first husband. He was my nephew, because Bert didn't know anything about that whole mess. But Dennis didn't remember me, I don't think. He wouldn't let go of my mum, wouldn't talk to me. And my mum told me it was too late now, and I shouldn't have left him if I wanted him so bad. So I went away without him."
The last time Agnes saw her son in the flesh was when she made a trip to his primary school and called him over to the fence to speak to her. Though he was barely 5, Creed claimed in our second interview to remember this final meeting.
"She was a thin, plain little woman dressed like a tart," he told me. "She didn't look like the other boys' mothers. You could tell she wasn't a respectable person. I didn't want the other children to see me talking to her. She said she was my mother, and I told her it wasn't true. But I knew it was, really.
I ran away from her. He didn't want nothing to do with me, said Agnes. I gave up after that. I wasn't going to go to the house if Audrey was there. Dennis was in school, at least. He looked clean. I used to wonder about him, how he was and that, Agnes said. Obviously you do. Kids come out of you. Men don't understand what that is. Yeah, I used to wonder, but I moved north with Bert when he got a job with a GPO, and I never went back to London. Not even when my mum died, because Audrey had put it about that if I turned up, he'd kick off.
When I told Agnes I'd met Dennis a mere week before visiting her in Romford, she had only one point of curiosity.
They say he's very clever, is he?
I told her that he was undoubtedly very clever. It was the one point on which all his psychiatrists agreed. Warders told me he read extensively, especially books of psychology.
I don't know where he got that from. Not me.
I read it all in the papers. I saw him on the news, heard everything he did.
Terrible. Just terrible. What would make a person do that? After the trial was over, I thought back to him all naked and bloody on the lino where I'd had him, with my stepfather standing over us, threatening to drown him. And I swear to you now, said Agnes Waite, I wish I'd let it happen.
Strike stubbed out his cigarette and reached for the can of Tennent's sitting beside the ashtray. A light rain pattered against his windows as he flicked a little further on in the book, pausing midway through chapter 2. Grandmother Ina was unwilling or unable to protect the youngest member of the household from her husband's increasingly sadistic punishments. Audrey took a particular satisfaction in humiliating Dennis for his persistent bedwetting. His step-grandfather would pour a bucket of water over his bed, then force the boy to sleep in it. Creed recalled several occasions on which he was forced to walk to the corner shop without trousers, but still wearing sodden pajama bottoms, to buy Audrey cigarettes.
One took refuge in fantasy,
Creed wrote to me later.
Inside my head I was entirely free and happy. But there were even then props in the material world that I enjoyed incorporating into my secret life. Items that attained a totemic power in my fantasies.
By the age of 12, Dennis had discovered the pleasures of voyeurism.
It excited me, he wrote, after our third interview, to watch a woman who didn't know she was being observed. I'd do it to my sisters, but I'd creep up to lit windows as well. If I got lucky, I'd see women or girls undressing, adjusting themselves, or even a glimpse of nudity. I was aroused not only by the obviously sensual aspects, but by the sense of power. I felt I stole something of their essence from them, taking that which they thought private and hidden.
He soon progressed to stealing women's underwear from neighbours' washing lines, and even from his grandmother, Ina. These he enjoyed wearing in secret and masturbating in. Yawning, Strike flicked on, coming to rest on a passage in chapter 4. A quiet member of the mailroom staff at Fleetwood Electric, who astonished his colleagues when, on a works night out, he donned the coat of a female co-worker to imitate singer Kay Starr.
There was little Dennis spelting out Wheel of Fortune in Jenny's coat,
an anonymous workmate told the press after Creed's arrest.
It made some of the older men uncomfortable. A couple of them thought he was, you know, queer after. But the younger ones, we all cheered him like anything. He came out of his shell a bit after that.
But Creed's secret fantasy life didn't centre on a life of amateur theatrics or pub singing. Unbeknownst to anyone watching the tips